What remains is the legality of these sanctions internationally, and what can be done to resolve the issues faced by these patients. So to discuss this situation further, we will be joined shortly by United Nations Special Rapporteur, Dr. Elena Duhan.
Dr. Elena Duhan is the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the negative impact of unilateral coercive measures on the enjoyment of human rights. She is a professor of international law. Her teaching and research concentrate on sanctions and human rights law, international law, and international environmental law. She is the author of more than 150 books and articles on international law. She has over 40 publications which focus on human rights, targeted and comprehensive sanctions, unilateral coercive measures, and freedom of opinion.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Duhan. What's your assessment of the effect of U.S. unilateral sanctions on the people of these nations?
Well, unfortunately, when it comes to the use of unilateral sanctions, usually the whole population of the country is affected quite broadly, especially in the health area. So situation in Iran is not so bad as it some other countries being under unilateral sanctions in a view of the fact that Iran is producing more than 90% of its medicine domestically. We need to take into account, however, that even when the country is producing the medicine domestically, people which are in need of this medicine may still be affected. Take into account that countries need to import raw materials for the medicine. And unfortunately, with the use of unilateral sanctions, especially the comprehensive unilateral sanctions towards Iran, many producers of raw materials are very much reluctant to sell raw materials to Iran. There are problems with delivery and payment. There is a need to use alternative means for payments and delivery. And therefore, it's very complicated to guarantee necessary quality of raw materials.
Well, you talked about the restrictions and the difficulties. What can be done about this situation?
I received information about this situation a few months ago, and I have drafted a communication to the company and to Sweden asking for the assistance on that situation. And unfortunately, the responses which I received unofficially were demonstrating the concerns of the company to be subjected to the sanctions of the United States from one side because of getting money from Iran. Secondly, there were concerns about the ways to get payment from Iran and the ways to deliver these bandages from Sweden to Iran. Previous time, that was UNICEF, which directly engaged into negotiations with Sweden, which resulted in the possibility to deliver the year storage of bandages. Unfortunately, the storage will be over around September this year. And now UNICEF is cooperating again with Sweden and the company trying to deliver these bandages to the EB patients. Unfortunately, as I have said, that's an ad hoc solution. After coming back from Iran, I also had a meeting with the ambassador of Sweden, and we discussed this situation, and I pointed out that the ad hoc solution is not a solution for the problem. People shall not leave not knowing whether they will be able to get the bandages tomorrow or in a year or not, and what caused them suffering and naturally deteriorate their quality of life. So I asked them to get engaged with the company and to guarantee the unimpeded procurement of this medicine.
What is it going to take to resolve this once and for all?
So the very first step, what the United Nations did, it established this mandate. So basically that was a response to the use of unilateral sanctions and plus to the humanitarian impact unilateral sanctions do. So as I have mentioned, I tried to raise awareness to show specific evidences of humanitarian impact, because what I often face in my work is when I start to talk to the embassies of the countries in which the companies producing the unique equipment are registered, they say, oh, we didn't know, we didn't realize that people are suffering that much and that people are dying. So that was the very first step. of the activity of the United Nations. Against, when we are speaking about the short-term solutions, the UN agencies in the countries, and in particular I speak about a number of specialized agencies in Iran, are very actively engaging now to guarantee the delivery of the basic medical goods necessary for the survival of the people. For example, UNICEF in Iran is very actively engaging to procure the bandages to the EB patients and to procure some other necessary medical equipment for people suffering from severe diseases. However, we need to realize that that's ad hoc solutions, trying to handle the situation for a very short period for a very limited group of people. Around a month ago, me together with some other special rapporteurs have issued a press release calling for a total lifting of unilateral sanctions imposed over critical infrastructure, medical goods, without any need to get extra licenses. Because today, unfortunately, something what has been announced to be called humanitarian exceptions is not functioning at all. It's necessary to get a license. It's necessary to find a way how to transfer money, how to guarantee the delivery. When we speak about EB patients in Iran, the recent attempt of UNICEF to deliver a little bit more than a year storage of bandages for EB patients took a year and a half. And today they are trying to engage into delivery of the second delivery. At the same time, I believe that the United Nations shall guarantee that this means all sorts of critical goods are exempted from the use of unilateral sanctions, first of all. In the long-term perspective, I try now to engage with many UN institutions as well as with states and humanitarian actors and scholars to bring attention to the issue of legality. If states will stop to use illegal means, that will mean that we won't need to have the notion what is called humanitarian exception, because sanctions will not be imposed and the states will be able to guarantee the delivery of life-saving medicine.
Thank you so much for being with us right here on Hidden Files, Dr. Elena Duhani. Now, Iran's EB patients have only a few months' worth of special bandages left. They don't know if and when they can receive the next shipment. Many are too young to even understand what sanctions are, and others can't see why their treatment should have anything to do with politics and sanctions against Iran, which are deemed illegal by international standards. Plus, it's not only EB patients who are suffering as a result of these sanctions. All patients whose required medicine and treatment are not entirely made in Iran are affected by these multifaceted sanctions. Now, this leaves Iran's doctors no choice but to either find a way to get around the sanctions or to tell their patients, sorry, I don't think that you will make it. Isn't it ironic, though, that these sanctions are placed on Iran by the U.S., which claims to be the flag bearer of human rights, when in reality, Washington has one of the worst records of waging wars against various nations, using their government's violation of these same rights as an excuse. And now the war is on. The U.S. government against special needs patients in sanctioned countries. Will the special needs patients win this battle and be able to heal their wounds, or will the U.S. manage to cause them to die in agony? Either way, these innocent patients will be the only victors in this cowardly war. Until next week, when we come to you to shed light on a whole other set of Hidden Files. Goodbye for me, Marzieh Hashemi, and from the whole crew right here in the studio.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. Your option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. in the limelight.
Poverty in the U.S. silently killed 10 times as many people as all the homicides in 2019. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Truthout wrote in this regard, a research published recently in the Journal of the American Medical Association estimated that poverty was linked to at least 183,000 deaths in the United States in 2019 among people aged 15 or older, making inadequate income the nation's fourth leading mortality driver that year behind heart disease, cancer, and smoking. Poverty kills as much as dementia, accidents, stroke, Alzheimer, and diabetes, said David Brady, a professor of public policy at the University of California, Riverside, and the lead author of the new analysis. Brady continued, "Poverty silently killed 10 times as many people as all the homicides in 2019, and yet homicide, firearms, and suicide get vastly more attention." Dr. William J. Barber, co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign, wrote recently that the research underlines the importance of connecting extremist inaction on gun violence to other forms of policy murder. The new analysis, co-authored by Ulrich Kohler of the University of Potsdam in Germany and Hoi Zheng of Ohio State University, stressed that the U.S. perennially has a far higher poverty rate than peer-rich democracies, which presents an enormous challenge to population health, given that considerable research demonstrates that being in poverty is bad for one's health. Poverty, which the study defined as less than half the median U.S. income, was associated with greater mortality than many far more visible causes in 2019. 10 times as many deaths as homicide, 4.7 times as many deaths as firearms, 3.9 times as many deaths as suicide, and 2.6 times as many deaths as drug overdose. The researchers argue their results indicate poverty should be considered a major risk factor for deaths in the U.S., which has seen life expectancy decline since 2015 and fall sharply amid the coronavirus pandemic. The researchers wrote, because the U.S. consistently has high poverty rates, these estimates can contribute to understanding why the U.S. has comparatively lower life expectancy, because certain ethnic and racial minority groups are far more likely to be in poverty. Our estimates can improve understanding of ethnic and racial inequalities in life expectancy. They continued, the mortality associated with poverty is also associated with enormous economic costs. Therefore, benefit-cost calculations of poverty-reducing social policies should incorporate the benefits of lower mortality. Moreover, poverty likely aggravated the mortality impact of COVID-19, which occurred after our analysis ended in 2019. Therefore, one limitation of this study is that our estimates may be conservative about the number of deaths associated with poverty. The onset of the coronavirus pandemic in 2020 brought about a sharp increase in U.S. poverty as millions of people got sick, were thrown out of work, and lost health insurance. But federal aid initiatives enacted in response to the public health and economic crisis, from stimulus checks to boosted unemployment benefits to enhanced nutrition assistance, ultimately led to a significant drop in poverty, further bolstering the case that poverty is a policy choice. However, many of those poverty-reducing aid programs, including the enhanced child tax credit that sharply slashed poverty among kids in the U.S., have since lapsed or been terminated, threatening to reverse any recent progress. Brady said in a statement that if the U.S. had less poverty, there would be a lot better health and well-being. People could work more and they could be more productive. He added, "Of all of these, there are benefits of investing in people through social policies." Also, according to the U.S. News, poverty is the fourth greatest cause of death in the United States, according to a new research. Researchers at the University of California, Riverside, estimate that poverty was associated with 183,000 deaths in 2019 among people 15 years old and older. And that's a conservative estimate, they say, because the year was just prior to the COVID-19 pandemic. People living in poverty have incomes less than 50% of the U.S. median income. The researchers noted in 2021, the median household income was $70,784 per household, according to the U.S. Census Bureau. Impoverished Americans have roughly the same survival rates as richer folks until they hit their 40s. Then they die at significantly higher rates, according to the study. The analysis found that only heart disease, cancer, and smoking kill more people than poverty. Deaths related to obesity, diabetes, drug overdoses, suicides, firearms, and homicides were all fewer than deaths associated with poverty.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Turkey's presidential election is headed for a runoff vote. That's according to official results from the country's Supreme Election Council. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan took 49.5% of Sunday's vote, with his main challenger, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, getting 44.89%. More than 64 million Turkish people, including overseas voters, were eligible to vote, and nearly 89% participated in the election to choose their next president and parliament for a five-year term. As neither secured more than 50% of the vote, they will face off in a second round on May 28th. This is only the third time that Turks directly voted for a president, with Erdogan winning both previous elections outright in the first round. Polls and observers had predicted an advantage, if not an outright victory, for 74-year-old Kılıçdaroğlu. But as the final results from Sunday's election were announced, it became clear 69-year-old Erdogan had defied expectations, seizing a majority along with his nationalist coalition partners in parliament and forcing a second-round vote in the presidential race. A voting observation mission by the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe said political participation was high and voters had a choice between two political alternatives, but the incumbent president and the ruling parties enjoyed an unjustified advantage, including through biased media coverage. The polls were held against a background of a cost-of-living crisis that saw inflation peak at 85% in October, and earthquakes in February that killed more than 50,000 people in the country. These factors buoyed opposition hopes of unseating a leader known as Reis, or chief, by supporters of the governing Justice and Development Party. Kılıçdaroğlu has promised to fix Turkey's faltering economy and restore democratic institutions compromised under Erdogan's rule. Erdogan, on the other hand, has been extolling the virtues of his long rule, campaigning on a platform of a stability, independent foreign policy, and continuing to bolster Turkey's defense industry. Recently, he raised the wage of government workers by 45% and lowered the retirement age. Taking place at the same time as the presidential race was the election of 600 parliamentary deputies. Although this was mostly lost amid the debate about Erdogan and Kılıçdaroğlu and whether either would gather more than 50% of the vote and thus avoid a second round. Turkey's election is widely considered to be the most important in the world this year, as a fight for the future of Turkish democracy and a possible shift in Turkey's influential role on the world stage. Parliamentary and presidential elections took place in Turkey on Sunday. In the 600-seat parliament, Erdogan's Justice and Development Party and its allies secured by far the most seats, 321, while the opposition won 213, and the 66 remaining seats went to a pro-Kurdish alliance. The elections are crucial to the future of Turkey's battered economy. Also, the vote had been presented as a last chance to stop Erdogan from turning the country into a full-blown autocracy. From 2003, Erdogan served three terms as prime minister. In 2014, when he was barred from running again, Erdogan stood for the largely ceremonial role of president. In 2016, he survived a coup, but that only strengthened his grip and consolidated his political standing in the country. A year later, he won a referendum that gave him sweeping presidential powers. While Erdogan's grip on the levers of power has brought Turkey close to autocracy, he has made serious economic missteps recently. He has increased his control of the theoretically independent central bank and steadfastly refused to increase interest rates despite soaring inflation. Turkish people are far poorer and more uncertain of their future as a result. The government response to the devastating recent earthquake was widely viewed as inadequate. In February, Erdogan made the tone-deaf comment that whatever happens, happens. This is part of fate's plan. However, he has outperformed expectations and appears to be further ahead than was previously predicted. Kılıçdaroğlu, a former accountant and bureaucrat and the longtime head of the Republican People's Party, was not a universally popular choice among the opposition to a stand. A social democrat, Kılıçdaroğlu is at the head of a coalition that includes nationalists who are only supporting him because of their desperation to unseat Erdogan. He has promised to stand down after a single term after instituting more conventional economic policies and restoring full parliamentary democracy. CHP leader Kılıçdaroğlu's six-party nation alliance has pledged to dismantle an executive presidential system narrowly voted in by a 2017 referendum. The opposition alliance also promised to restore the independence of the judiciary and the central bank and to reverse crackdowns on free speech and dissent under Erdogan. Turkey's elections had been billed as the most consequential since its first fair multi-party polls in 1950, boiling down to a choice between five more years of Erdogan, Turkey's most electorally successful politician, or a new direction under an old party that has reinvented itself in recent years.
Go. Gaza Strip, and yet again, another Israeli deadly aggression on the blockaded territory that finally ended following an Egypt-brokered truce on Saturday. The five-day onslaught claimed the lives of over 30 people, including women and children. The Palestinian fatalities included several Islamic Jihad commanders. Khalil al-Bahtini, the commander of the Al-Quds brigades in the northern Gaza Strip, Tariq Azzedine, a spokesperson for the Islamic Jihad, who also managed retaliatory operations in the West Bank and Gaza, and Jihad al-Ghannam, secretary of the movement's military council, were all among those assassinated along with their families. A total of 51 Palestinian houses were completely destroyed, while about 1,000 others were damaged, prompting many people across Gaza to become homeless.
Now we are homeless, so we have no choice but to sleep on the street. Everything of us is ruined. I am worried about my children and other family members.
I demand compensation following this ceasefire because we are living on the streets now, no house or anything. My children and their children have no home. We are all left with nothing.
The conflict marked the worst episode of fighting between Gaza's resistance factions and the Israeli regime since the 10-day war in 2021. The carnage was to the extent which drew reaction from the United Nations. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres condemned the Israeli regime's onslaught on Gaza as unacceptable. The UN chief also called on the Israeli regime to immediately stop the bloodshed. Guterres said Israel must abide by its obligations under international humanitarian law, including proportionate use of force and taking all feasible precautions to spare civilians and civilian objects in the conduct of military operations. The UN chief also censured the Israeli closure of Gaza border crossings, which prevented the entry of foodstuff, medical supplies, and fuel into the besieged coastal territory. The latest Israeli aggression on Gaza brings to the spotlight the power and strength the Palestinian resistance groups have attained during the past several years. A joint statement by resistance factions in Gaza is a testimony to that. The statement said their retaliatory rocket attacks and the steadfastness of resistance fighters messed up the regime's calculations during the recent onslaught on Gaza. It added the new round of fighting with the occupying Israeli regime further strengthened the resistance front. The Zionist enemy mistakenly believed that the time was ripe for assassination of Palestinian resistance leaders, but it was a grave miscalculation. The umbrella group said that Israeli military officials had planned to wrap up the latest onslaught on the Gaza Strip in a very short span of time, but were stunned by the scope of resistance fighters' preparedness and rapid response to air raids. The groups warned Israel against the implementation of the policy of targeted killings, adding that resistance fighters have their fingers on the trigger and will not hesitate to respond in case the regime in Tel Aviv resorts to assassinations. But with Israeli officials admitting that the Islamic Jihad fired 6,000 rockets toward the occupied territories, it seems that the power of Palestinian resistance has already done the job, creating fear and threat among Israeli authorities. With all the fuss about the Israeli Iron Dome, numerous Palestinian rockets managed to intrude into the airspace of the occupied territories and inflict their stated losses. The death of an Israeli settler as a result of those rocket fires during the recent conflict was an indication of that. What seems to be of very high significance is that assassinating Palestinian commanders will not bring security to the Israeli regime and instead will enhance the extent of resistance on the part of Palestinian factions and increase their resolve in the face of the Israeli atrocities. That not only will cost Israel a heavy price in case of any gross miscalculations, as resistance leaders have put it, but will undoubtedly challenge the existence of an occupying regime. The United States, and yet another example of racial discrimination. A video circulating on social media has showed a former U.S. Marine killing a mentally ill African-American homeless man by putting him in a chokehold on the New York City subway. The video shows a former Marine identified as Daniel Penny, grabbing 30-year-old Jordan Neely around the neck while pinning him to the ground on a train in Manhattan. The medical examiner said Neely died from a compression of the neck. The incident happened on May the 1st. Witnesses say the African-American man was loudly complaining about being hungry and saying he was ready to die. They say the victim showed no behavior that was threatening to the subway passengers. Penny, 24, restrained him until the homeless man appeared to stop moving. Neely was taken to a hospital where he was later declared dead. Penny's lawyers say their client could not have known that his forceful actions, which were meant to subdue the mentally ill man, would lead to the victim's death. Penny, who had been questioned and released by police in New York on the day of the incident, later surrendered to police and was arraigned in Manhattan Criminal Court after prosecutors lodged criminal charges against him. Two other unidentified people who were also seen restraining Neely in the footage have yet to be charged. Neely's death sparked angry protests.
Justice for Jordan! Justice for Jordan! Justice for Jordan! Justice for Jordan! Justice for Jordan!
A system that has been meant to destroy us. A system that didn't want to see Jordan Neely alive.
Right.
Let me be very clear. It failed no one. It did exactly what it was designed to do.
The demonstrators called Neely's death an act of lynching, likening it to the murder of George Floyd by white officers in 2020. The killing of the African-American man also drew reactions from some U.S. officials. New York City Mayor Eric Adams called the incident a tragedy that never should have happened. He pledged to do more to help people experiencing mental health crisis. The latest incident of racial discrimination in the U.S. comes as brutality against black people is happening at record numbers. Just to make that evident, 21 African Americans were killed by U.S. law enforcement officers only in January 2023. That already makes the year one of the deadliest ever so far for the African American community in the U.S. That includes the tragic death of Keena Darnell Anderson, who was tased by police officers in Los Angeles following a car accident. Those are only a few recent incidents of brutality of racial discrimination against blacks. The United States has a long history of such bias against people of color. One major example was a brutal killing of a 46-year-old black man named George Floyd, who died after a white police officer pressed on his neck for more than 9 minutes during an arrest in May 2020 in Minneapolis, Minnesota. The death of the handcuffed black man triggered months of widespread protests, not only in cities across the U.S., but also other parts of the world. Those incidents come as African Americans and other ethnic minorities are often subject to harsh discrimination and racial profiling by white supremacists in the United States. One reason could be that U.S. politicians not only have failed to bring an end to racial profiling against the people of color, but at times have fanned the flames of hatred against them. That could clearly be seen when former U.S. President Donald Trump was in office. The former president numerously emboldened white supremacists with his racist remarks during his tenure. U.S. President Joe Biden, who took the helm in 2021, claimed to be a critic of racial injustice, but he also failed to eradicate racial discrimination in the country. With many arguing that America was built on slavery, it is not erroneous to claim that racial profiling against African Americans and other people of color is deeply rooted in American culture. Maybe that's why it is too early to think that putting an end to prejudice and racism in the U.S. does not seem to be happening anytime soon.
Shock and desperation. Children traumatized. Mothers losing their children. Israel claims it is not targeting civilians, but the injured and the dead tell another story. Like dead Palestinian girl carried by her father. With over 100 wounded, how many times will Israel kill civilians like women and children yet claim it is targeting resistance fighters and leaders. When is it enough?
Are you ready to say enough is enough? As the highest authority responsible for the maintenance of international peace and security?
As of Saturday, May 13, Israel has so far assassinated 6 Islamic Jihad leaders, and it has stated it is after more blood. The killing machine has no mercy. One bombing operation involved 40 aircrafts and drones, courtesy of the United States. The incessant sound of drones creates a constant state of terror, panic, and anxiety among the 2 million people living in the Gaza Strip. Al-Mizan, a human rights group based in Gaza, notes that between the years 2000 and 2023, at least 2,148 Palestinians, including 378 children and 86 women, were killed by Israeli drones. Nearly 350 were killed inside their homes, including more than 100 children, underscoring the reality that there is no safe place in Gaza. And these are conservative figures. Resistance groups in the Gaza Strip have not stood idle. Palestinian factions, like the Islamic Jihad, said they are united in their joint response. Resistance factions have been relentless in their rocket attacks. Many have reached as far as Tel Aviv, or close to it, like the town, which claimed the life of one Israeli, injuring 5 others. Israel getting a taste of its own medicine. As a matter of fact, the resistance group's firepower has overwhelmed Israel's so-called Iron Dome system. In one tally, more than 500 rockets were fired at Israel. Of these, 368 rockets made it over the border, and 154 were intercepted by the so-called Iron Dome missile defense system. Simple math shows that this dome had a 30% success rate. And Israel better be careful. Reports indicate it has so far only hit Islamic Jihad targets. Israel knows that Palestinian resistance groups are believed to be capable of firing thousands of rockets, which could quickly exhaust Israel's Iron Dome anti-missile system. On top of that, Israel is unable to sustain prolonged disruption to its civilian economy amid widespread fear and panic among its population. Israel is now at its weakest. Regionally, it is isolated more than ever. Iran and Saudi Arabia's reconciliation have solidified the axis of resistance, especially after Saudi Arabia hosted Hamas recently and is warming up to Hezbollah. And from within, Israel is unraveling due to the revolt by Israelis against the judicial reforms. Protests now in its 4th month. There's growing consensus that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu launched the assault on Gaza to appease his fractious, extreme coalition, particularly Itamar Ben-Gvir, in order to distract from the protests. Yet Netanyahu may be risking it all when the Tel Aviv skyline is filled with too many rockets that would rain down and eliminate its presence on Palestinian land.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. U.S. officials are still preparing for a big surge in the number of migrants crossing into the United States from the southern border with Mexico. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. National broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. Pandemic-era limits on asylum, known as Title 42, have been rarely discussed among many of the tens of thousands of migrants massed on Mexico's border with the United States. Their eyes were and are fixed instead on a new U.S. government mobile app that grants 1,000 people daily an appointment to cross the border and seek asylum while living in the United States. With demand far outstripping available slots, the app has been an exercise in frustration for many, and a test of the Biden administration's strategy of coupling new legal paths to entry with severe consequences for those who don't. You start to give up hope, but that's the only way, said Teresa Munoz, a 48-year-old who abandoned her home in the Mexican state of Michoacán, after a gang killed her husband and beat her. She has been trying for a month to gain entry through the app called CBP One, while staying in a Tijuana shelter with her two children and two-year-old grandson. Manuel Sanchez, a 40-year-old, told CBS News that he's been trying and failing to secure an immigration appointment on CBP One. He said he and other Venezuelan migrants might head back if they can't get appointments. U.S. Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas said the Border Patrol made 6,300 arrests on Friday, 12th of May, the first day after Title 42 expired, and 4,200 arrests on Saturday, 13th of May. That's sharply below the 10,000-plus on 3 days last week, as migrants rushed to get in before new policies to restrict asylum took effect. It's still early, Mayorkas said on Sunday on CNN's State of the Union program. We're in day three, but we have been planning for this transition for months and months, and we have been executing on our plan, and we will continue to do so. Despite the drop in recent days, authorities predict arrests will spike to between 12,000 and 14,000 a day. Matthew Hudak, Deputy Border Patrol Chief, said in a court filing on Friday. And authorities cannot confidently estimate how many will cross, Hudak said, noting intelligence reports failed to quickly flag a singular surge of 18,000, predominantly Haitian migrants in Del Rio, Texas, in September of 2021. More than 27,000 migrants were in custody along the border one day last week, a number that may top 45,000 by the end of May, if authorities can't release migrants without orders to appear in immigration court, Hudak said. The Biden administration plans to ask an appeals court on Monday for permission to release migrants without orders to appear in court. Authorities say it takes between 90 minutes and 2 hours to process a single adult for court appearance, potentially choking Border Patrol holding facilities, and longer to process families. By contrast, it only takes about 20 minutes to release someone with instructions to report to an immigration office in 60 days, a common practice since 2021 to ease overcrowding along the southern border with Mexico. The Justice Department even raised the possibility of declining to take people into custody if it can't quickly release migrants, calling that a worst-case scenario. President Joe Biden, spending the weekend at his home in Rehoboth Beach, Delaware, said his hope was that the border numbers would continue to go down, but that we have a lot more work to do. We need some more help from Congress as well in terms of funding and legislative changes, Biden told reporters. President Biden said managing the situation at the border, however, was going much better than you all expected. The administration is touting new legal pathways in an effort to deter illegal crossings, including parole for 30,000 Cubans, Haitians, Nicaraguans and Venezuelans a month who apply online with a financial sponsor and arrive at an airport. Hundreds of predominantly Colombian migrants waited to be processed on Saturday in searing heat near Jacumba, California. Having slept for days in thatched tents east of San Diego and getting by on the Border Patrol's limited supply of cookies and water. CNN cable news network has also covered this story and tells us more. The United States is bracing for the expiration of a pandemic-era border restriction this week, with officials fearing it will spur a surge of migrants and exacerbate an already challenging humanitarian crisis at the southern border with Mexico. No matter how much we're prepared, I don't think we're going to be prepared enough. John Martin, deputy director of the Opportunity Center for the Homeless in El Paso, Texas, told CNN on Sunday. Title 42 is a Trump-era policy that allowed the government to quickly turn away certain migrants at the border with Mexico, originally with the aim of stopping the spread of COVID-19. I wanted to emphasize more so than anything else at this point, this is a national issue. John Martin, deputy director of the Opportunity Center for the Homeless in El Paso, Texas, said. We here in El Paso, along with many other communities along the southern border, just happen to be at the front doorstep. While first implemented under the Trump administration as a response to the pandemic, Title 42 has been kept in place by the courts and used by the Biden administration to deal with migrants at the southern border with Mexico. U.S. Customs and Border Protection has already seen an uptick in migrants crossing the border with Mexico, with more than 8,000 daily encounters, according to a Homeland Security official, a number that officials predict could reach 10,000 once Title 42 has been lifted. There are around 25,000 migrants in custody, the official said, straining processing facilities that are already over capacity. I think that there is no question that this is going to be extremely challenging, Department of Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas said on Friday, 12th of May, speaking in Brownsville, Texas. Mayorkas was speaking during a visit to the Rio Grande Valley. I do not want to understate the severity of the challenge that we expect to encounter. But federal officials have long been preparing for the end of Title 42, Alejandro Mayorkas stressed, saying the government was ready. We have a plan, he said. Still in a news conference on Monday morning, Texas Governor Greg Abbott likened the expiration of Title 42 as the laying out of a welcome mat to migrants across the world, signaling to them America's borders are wide open. Texas Governor Greg Abbott said, it will lead to an incredible amount of people coming across the border illegally. The administration's policies would cause a catastrophic disaster.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم. all of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor, Israel. Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Ideal University Student brings change in thinking and reality of the society and world. The following is part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution in a meeting with university students and representatives of student associations in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on April 18, 2023. The opinions expressed regarding political matters, economic issues and some decisions, these are opportunities. These opinions are opportunities. I'm not saying they are correct. Pay attention to this. Some of them may be correct, others may not be. But the act of expressing your opinion and thinking about a problem, this is an opportunity for the country. Of course, it is possible for there to be damages associated with it. Student activities should not suffer from deviations. Be careful. Of course, young people find it hard to believe that elderly people were young at one time too. But we have experienced youthhood as well, and we know what it's like to be young. The probability of making errors and mistakes while young is high. Various things happen. Be careful. We need to overcome the deviations in student activities. We need to create a healthy environment. Don't create bipolarities. Student activities should not polarize the student community or the country. This is one of the most important issues. The enemy wants this kind of polarization. Student activities should be realistic.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Now, for example, you come here and make a recommendation. This recommendation may need time or be expensive. It may not be possible to pay the costs to do it. It may not be within reach. You need to pay attention to these things, so student activities and demands must be realistic. They should be accompanied by the presentation of a scientific, practical solution as much as possible. First of all, a scientific solution means that it should be academic and well thought out. Secondly, when we talk about a practical solution, this means that it should not be written on paper. It should be something that is possible to do. If anyone here enters into the field of action, his or her opinion will change from what it is now. Now, some of you have made some requests. You asked why they don't bring the youth to get involved. Of course, they must do this. But your opinion will change because you will see the realities. You will see the problems and you will see the difficulties associated with doing the work.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.